Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. Before listening, make sure you subscribe and share so more people can find us. In October of last year, during Imagine Film Festival right here in Lab 111, I had the pleasure of speaking to first-time director Sean Price-Williams and actress Talia Ryder about their new film, The Sweet East. Now, despite it being his directorial debut, Williams has been an active and celebrated indie film photographer for almost two decades, even being dubbed one of the more important makers in the new independent American cinema by my wonderful co-host and film critic Hugo Emmerzaal. Perhaps you're already a big fan of Williams' work, or you might have gotten to experience them unbeknownst to you in films such as Alex Ross Perry's Listen Up Philip or the Safdie brothers' Good Time. Talia Ryder, who plays the lead in the film, is still a relative newcomer, making her breakthrough with indie film Never Rarely Sometimes Always in 2020, but she has already made quite the name for herself in the meantime, seamlessly swinging between independent and big production projects alike. The Sweet East is a critical love letter to Williams' home turf, the American East Coast. In a dreamlike but gritty road movie, high schooler Lillian ditches her school trip to wander the East Coast with an aloof abandon that allows everyone she meets to treat her as a blank canvas of sorts, project their own ideologies on. The journey takes us past different hyper-specific niche groups that paint a picture of a fractured America, but manages to keep a carefully hopeful notion nonetheless.
You sure you're in the right place? Feel certain I've never seen you at one of these affairs before.
Little Bo Peep has lost her way.
I don't think she'd be scared. I think she's really braver than you think.
The election was a pre-scripted puppet show, just like every year.
No, you two are a complete pair of cosmopolitan snobs, you know that, yeah?
What in your young life could you have encountered to inspire you?
I don't know. I never really cared about that stuff. Glad they figured out how to make movies like less boring than this.
Did they?
Now, though I undoubtedly love film, as you probably know by now from our other episodes, I'm relatively new to the depths of film nerd culture. So going into this film was a wild ride for me. It meant that many of its references went over my head, but that didn't diminish my experience in any way. As you will hear later in the interview, the best way to describe my experience of The Sweet East is as a piece of cinema that invents a language that it doesn't bother to teach you. It takes from Williams and Pinkerton's extensive film knowledge and creates something that feels completely new, yet not, for it makes tangible all that came before, even if it's not something that you're familiar with, like I was. And perhaps it might even make you want to go on an adventure yourself. Now let's get into the interview. Before we jump into the film, I'd like to start with the question that we always start our podcast with, and that is, what is a film that you've watched lately?
I do watch movies in my hotel room, usually at night, but it's a very strange curation that I do. And I could talk about a movie that I've watched twice this week, actually, hotel room, but it's not a good movie at all. It's a movie that kind of just haunted me the first time. And then we were together with our writer, Nick Pinkerton. And I said, Nick, you got to come to my room and watch this movie. I don't know why I'm really haunted by it. And he watched it with me and he thinks it's absolutely no good. But it's a 1980 Canadian movie called Mr. Patman, P-A-T-M-A-N, with James Coburn. He's a nurse at a mental hospital and he starts to lose his mind. It's not really a thriller. It's not a drama. It's not a comedy. It's one of these movies that I think, you know, we get fascinated by because there's absolutely no audience in mind for it when it was made. Mm. I think I can't imagine what purpose the movie was made. And I like that usually automatically. So yeah, I would say, and I'm writing to distributor friends about it. It only was available on VHS and it's been forgotten since then. I'd like to resurrect this film somehow. Anyway, Mr. Patman.
Cool. How about you, Talia?
Yeah, a little less niche, but, yesterday I watched Wild at Heart, David Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
I
I really liked that movie. And
Have you seen it before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just was really overtired and couldn't watch anything new.
Right. Then you always go back to your safe watches.
I feel like whenever I'm really overtired and I just like, I need a comfort movie, I always watch a David Lynch movie. Even if it's like kind of disturbing, it's like somewhat easy to digest.
I was going to say, that's pretty interesting that you go to Lynch for easy.
It's comforting. All of them look like places that you've like been before. Mm.
I think the reason I watch Mr. Patman, for example, is I have a lot of things that are just ripped from VHS, like files of my things. I like watching like the VHS, you know, even though it's a digital file, if it has that VHS quality to it, that's my comfort. Okay. I think that's why I watch those things. We did like a secret screening in Ghent for a movie that's actually playing here too. We got one of the filmmakers, Prince. It's called Vas de Nos. It's a 70s Belgian movie.
What's it about?
Internationally, it's known as the pig fucking movie. And that's the title. That's the title. In it.
Okay, great.
So we did like a secret screening of that in Ghent and showed that to a lot of people that didn't know what they were in for.
People ran from the theater.
Yeah, actually, when the sex starts to happen, there were people running. Actually running out the
running,
theater.
Running, wow.
It's really beautiful, actually. I think it's a really like a, it's a, you know, it has a very strange power.
Yeah.
It's not
I
cheap.
I liked it.
This reminds me of one time they went to see Crash in theater. People ran as well. Yeah. Like in the beginning, for sure, this is a film about people that get very sexually excited about car crashes for people who haven't seen it. People ran from the theater. And then when you think that everyone who's kind of queasy has left the theater, then about a third of the way through, two thirds, there's two men that give each other a kiss. And there was a whole new wave of people leaving. And I was like, this is a very innocent kiss. And for this, you now decide to leave?
I've only seen that film one time. And it was right when it came out. I'd sort of just started driving myself. I'd read the book. I read the book when I got my license. And the book is extremely, it's unfilmable, the book. And so when I saw the movie, I was just so disappointed. You know, the book, the movie's so soft compared to the book.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the book is incredible. It's incredible. I mean, the writing is just, the visuals that it puts in your head, you know, it screws you up. But I want to rewatch them. I'm sure the movie's great, actually. I just was really being snobby back then.
Let's get into The Sweet East. Can either of you maybe give a short summary for listeners that haven't seen it?
Well, at the time we were making it and before, I can't remember even how we described it. Now we always use Road Movie or Alice in Wonderland because that's what people have put that in our heads since we made the film. Like an Alice in Wonderland road trip through contemporary America, following this character Lillian who's just on a high school trip and she sort of breaks off and we see a sort of certain corners of the East Coast of America through her eyes, I guess.
It's a story about a girl who goes from being a side character in her own life to stepping into the role as a main character.
The visual language of this film was so interesting to me. I was trying to explain to Elliot yesterday what my experience watching this film was, and it was very difficult. Like, I looked at my notes that I made while I was watching it, and like most things I wrote down were like, what is this? What is happening? I didn't see that coming. Things keep changing. And so as one does, I went to Letterboxd to kind of read reviews and see if I could find the words there. And someone wrote, I think this encapsulates it pretty nicely. Someone
wrote some words there.
They very much do, yes. Someone wrote, my favorite kind of cinema has always been that which invents a language that it doesn't bother teaching you. And I thought
that's really profound for Letterboxd.
For sure. You can find profound things there. But I think that really describes the way that I experienced this film. Could you talk a bit about how, why you felt the need to tell the story in this way? How that come to happen?
Yeah, I don't want to interpret that person's comment one way or another, I guess, but I like it. When going into this film, I was a lot more focused on the role of director, which is something it was my sort of first time directing something like this size, and that was much more my focus. I sort of let the cinematography element go a little into an auto, be operated automatically maybe a little bit. I wasn't so thoughtful of it. I had sort of just general strategies for each sequence to kind of have a just to have a kind of a game plan, very simple game plan, but I wasn't so thoughtful. But in general, I don't really think I have any style because I'm always trying to change any movie I do. I try to make it different than the one before. What I don't like is making a shot that seems, I don't want to say perfect, but even close to perfect. I think, especially with some of these movies that it's like, it has to be a little trashed, the image, because it feels irrelevant and unattached to, I don't know, my experiences. If you see perfect shots, I love watching movies with perfect lighting and perfect, you know, frames and things, but I don't like seeing that through a viewfinder, actually. I think it's, so I got to trash it up a little bit somehow. So I wonder if that's like kind of a thing. And also grabbing stills from the movie, I find it to be, they don't really work as stills. I think it has to be moving. I think that's something that I can't take still photograph. I'm terrible still photographer. If somebody asks me to take a picture of them with their cell phone, it's always the worst picture in their phone, you know, the eyes or anything. I just fail at it. So it's got to be moving. I think that's.
Yeah, this is your first time directing, but you've obviously been on a film set many, many times as a cinematographer. You've worked with some great directors, so you have seen a lot of directors at work. Was there anything that really surprised you in working as a director yourself?
I wasn't surprised, but I was definitely learning a lot, and I was becoming more sympathetic to the directors I've worked with, like things that I've been frustrated with them before from watching as a cinematographer, decisions I've seen them make more in post-production, things that would just aggravate me. And I just understand how, you know, when somebody says, oh, it just didn't work, you know, this scene just didn't work, I understand that better now. I also understand that, you know, when you're a director, unless you have a personal assistant, you're a director, you go on a set, you have your bag with your whatever, your phone and your sunglasses, and there's nowhere to put it, you know? Whereas when I'm a cinematographer, there's like a camera cart, and I've got my assistants there. When you're a director, you're really like kind of alone. It's actually the loneliest job on the film, and I got a real taste of that. Even though I was surrounded entirely by people and mostly friends even, it still was, there's a kind of loneliness there.
How was it for you, Talia, to be directed by Sean?
It was a lot of fun, even though I didn't know Sean before filming the movie. I feel like it was the first, we started filming in Andy's New York. We filmed the stuff with Rish's character first in the cabin. Being isolated upstate forces you to get to know people quicker than maybe you would if you were just in the city or something. But I don't know, the night before we all hung out, this will work out. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like Sean just made it very clear from the beginning that he trusted me a lot and made me feel, empowered is like a corny word, but empowered to just do my own thing and do whatever I wanted as Lillian, and that he would kind of follow my lead in that sense. And it was really cool to be given that amount of power. I mean, that's like, I don't know, I feel like that's how acting should be, but it just isn't a lot of the time. And yeah, and apart from that, it was really fun too. We got to travel all over the East Coast for this movie, and it was a combination of a lot of things, the traveling, the friends on set. I got to bring some of my friends on set. Cast a few of my friends and my sister in a role in the film. And yeah, it was a really good time.
Going back to the casting process, Sean, you've said before that Talia was the first person you spoke to for Lillian and that you kind of immediately knew that you liked her. How is it the other way around for you, Talia? Did you immediately feel that as well?
No, I don't know. I was like, I didn't really like understand like what it was that you were going to do. I read the script and I was like kind of confused, but I really liked it. And I had a lot of questions about it. And a lot of the questions I asked Sean was like, oh, I don't know, what do you think? And at first I was like, I think that's like really honest as a filmmaker to be like, actually, that would be up to you.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that made me really excited and more curious about a lot of things, because it was the idea that I could answer all these things for myself and really dig into something on my own was really exciting. I remember I wrote like an insane email to Sean about the self-tape and like got super specific about something.
Yeah, that was also part of why we knew that you should be in the film. I mean, you were asking these crazy questions that showed like such a interest in it and also just an understanding. And like, I was like, whoa, this person is really, this is a really bright person asking who really is going to do something with this character if she's asking these questions already. So yeah, she was the first person. Well, yeah, it goes back a few years. There was somebody else when we first wrote it. I mean, Talia would have been 11 years old probably then. But it wasn't serious. We didn't actually have a real movie happening. It was just a script and a bit of a fantasy. And then there was a girl that was sort of a real teen runaway that I was like, oh, we should definitely work with a real teenage runaway girl. I think that's a really great idea, because then she'll just teach us everything about. And then my producer's like, okay, well, she's 16. We can't take her across state lines or anything. We'll go to jail if we hire this person. Okay. All right. So then let's meet some real actors. And she was the first person I met as like a real actor when this thing was actually happening. Mm. And I said, well, that was cool. She's pretty special. She's going to be great. But you know, who casts the very first person that they talk to? It doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
So I met a whole bunch of other people, or not really, like mostly Zoom meetings, because it was still kind of COVID-y time. Natalia met me in person, which ultimately also was really meaningful. I could say for a lot of reasons it was meaningful, just because she was brave enough to, you know,
brave enough to go to Veselka. Outside,
yeah, sit outside a restaurant and talk to me. We talked to other people, but I was just like, yeah, you know, but she's, you know, I guess it works that way sometimes.
Yeah, you did amazing as Lillian. Did you guys watch any films together or share any recommendations between the two of you to prepare for this role?
The Michael Clark movie.
Yeah.
Movie called Hail the New Puritan. I mean, there's so many movie theaters in New York to play older film repertory stuff. And there was like a film that I really love. It's a British dance film called Hail the New Puritan. And it was playing at the Metrograph. And I knew Talia had this dance history. And I said, oh, let's just, you know, I was very intimidated still by her at that point. So I was like, this is kind of a strange movie to try to see together as in some sort of context of the film we were about to make. It's a 16mm, like, I don't know, I thought about it many times while we were making the film, actually. So that was about maybe a couple weeks before we started shooting.
The humor, I think back to, there's, like, a final sequence in the movie where they're doing, like, these interviews at a club, but the humor's really similar.
Yeah, yeah. And just the kind of party nature of the film.
Yeah.
Seemed like it was a fun movie to make.
There's an apartment in that movie that, after seeing it, like, I based my dream apartment on. And now I kind of have it.
Yeah, you almost got it now, actually.
Nice.
You know, in general, when I'm about to do a movie or something, I'll watch something that's entirely not relevant and sort of get some ideas from that. And one of the ones for this one was I'd watched the Sting documentary, Bring on the Night, from the 80s, and the lighting in it is just really beautiful. There's a scene where his wife gives birth. There's a birthing scene in a French hospital. It's just gorgeous. So that was something that was in my head too, but again, not really clearly connected.
So I hear music here. The previous one was dance, so music as well. The music in this film is something, not only music, but also the sound design was something that really stuck with me. Do you take a very musical approach to your films, or how is that a big part of it?
Yeah, I mean, part of why I want to make movies is just to put some music in it. You know, I have like some music I've been listening to now. It's like, well, I got to make a movie just to put this in it. And, you know, I can't imagine, even when I would work on movies for other people, like with the Safdies and all, I would be always throwing songs at them and say, you got to put this in here. I would listen to music while I was shooting a lot of time back then. I would have my iPod in like one ear. I'd have a headphone. So I was like watching it like a movie while I'm shooting. I don't really do that anymore because I think it might look rude to some people, but I would sort of, I would like be, yeah, I'm always kind of suggesting music and also, and this one, I have a real eclectic bunch of music that I really wanted to use. And for the most part, I got to really, it worked, you know, like sometimes you try to put in too much different stuff. It just turns into a mess and it's incoherent, but I think we found some sort of a, I wouldn't say homogenous, but it's like, I think it works, but yeah, it's important to use.
There's like so many like different vibes in the movie that yeah. the different vibes of the music makes sense.
I yeah. The like. Episodic nature of the movie makes it kind of work.
Yeah, for sure. I felt that as well.
And there's some original music and then a lot of just stuff that I don't understand why it's not better known. I like the idea of like the song at the end of the film, the Minimal Man song. I mean, I would love it if that was, you know, played everywhere you go, you know, instead of New Order or something like 80s thing. You know, it's like, how about, like, there's a lot of other stuff, guys.
Talia, did you have any specific inspiration for playing this film?
Are there any actors that you really like? I've never even really asked you this.
Yeah.
Is anybody
I guess more like specific roles stand out to me. I guess what I kept thinking about, it's so random, but when the time I was filming this movie, I went back and watched the scene a bunch. I don't know who directed it, but there's this film called Beautiful Girls.
The 90s movie?
Yeah. Natalie Portman's character in that, like, I just remember watching that, and she just has these scenes with like older men that she talks to, and
that's
kind of like this film.
Makes a lot of sense, actually. You never.
But I remember being really young watching that and being like, "Wow!" Like falling in love with her, and being like, she could do or say anything, and she knows what she's doing. She's like an interesting, like, I mean, obviously. But it's just cool to see. You can just see that she's turned on and she's performing, which is cool. But I didn't want you to see as much that Lillian's performing. I think like she's maybe an even better actress herself than her character in that. I'm not saying I'm a better actress. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it. The character is. But yeah, I guess I thought about that.
It's funny. It makes sense.
Also, Leonardo DiCaprio. The Wolf of Wall Street, I thought about a lot, but I always think about that, so I don't know. I don't think that's this movie specific, but...
I was going to say, that's very interesting for this role.
Beautiful Girls is one of those movies where all of us were like, oh, that's a really good movie. Like I was maybe 18 or 19, but I know I remember like adults, because I worked at a video store back then, they were like, oh yeah, it's a really intelligent, really good film. It's like, no, everyone just is in love with Natalie Portman. That's like the guys watching them, everybody, we're just like, no, don't fool yourself. I can't imagine that movie's really very good.
I haven't even gone back and watched the movie. Only gone back and watched her scenes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been curious to just put it on.
Do you remember the first time you watched that? Was that before you got into acting?
Yeah. I remember my mom showing it to me. I don't know, when I was like 13 or 14.
Wow. So would you say that it has been like influential for you becoming an actress yourself?
Yeah, I guess it has been. But I really haven't watched the movie since. It's just been her scenes. I mean, I guess on me and the rest of the middle-aged men in the world, really impactful.
I'd like to go back a bit, which I guess kind of relates to what you said about, I already forgot the name of the film that you watched, Mr. Patman.
Never forget it again.
You said that you liked it because you don't know what reason it was made for. Mm. We were kind of talking about this as well yesterday, that so this film is about a teenage girl, but it was made by two middle-aged men. There's kind of a lot of contradictions in it. There's a few quite well-known commercially successful actors in it, but then it's filled to the brim with these references for true cinephiles. Who did you make this film for?
Because I worked at video stores for 10 years. I still sometimes see, okay, what section does this, you know, movie go in? And it was action adventure. There's fantasy. There's, you know, horror, sci-fi. You know, it's these kind of, some video stores have like a love section, you know, a wrestling section. There used to be a lot of different categories. Or the catch-all, maybe, after the in late 90s, was the independent film section, which was sort of like a not a section that I was very fond of. Somebody mentioned Dazed and Confused. Maybe our movie, a lot of the people in it will have great careers after, the ones that weren't already having them. I've never seen Dazed and Confused. I worked at the video stores, and the kind of the most obnoxious people would come in and rent sermon. Even David Lynch movies I didn't really rate very highly at the time, because it was really, it was like weirdly college dudes and bros and stuff. Which is really kind of hard to think right now. But
I'm like scared to say that, like, oh, I just watched a David Lynch movie, because every Q&A someone raises their hand.
Yeah,
like, which David Lynch movie did you watch this?
I treasure him now, you know. There was a period there where I just, you know, couldn't do it. But I think Nick, definitely the writer and I, we love to think of making movies that are, I mean, it's you want people to see it, like, for sure. I never want to make a movie that just becomes obscure and lost. I mean, you know, it doesn't really make any sense to do that. You know, we want to open people's minds. But we want to make sure that it's something that doesn't seem too familiar. Yeah, in any situation. I think that's why the movie is, it's sort of maybe a little bit psychotic or something.
And why was it important for you to use the teenage girl as a vehicle to tell this story?
Because Nick always says it, but I'll say it. Because if it was a teenage boy, then it would be homosexual story. I mean, it's really that simple. And while we're not any more equipped maybe to make a story from the point of view of a teenage girl, I feel like we're even less ready to tackle that, you know. So it's really like that. I mean, there's a lot of the characters and the situations are all things that we experienced, not even I just think that it would be, if it was a young boy, there would just be this hint of it, you know. It would just be always suggested, and I don't know how we would get around it, you know. So it's not, it just seemed to make more sense. Plus, I mean, we wanted to watch a movie about, like, it's like Candy, the Terry Southern movie, or book, I'm sorry, the book is great, the movie's terrible, but that was another inspiration. So it's just more fun to watch a girl, you know. I know I'm probably saying cancelable things here. It's just, I would rather always watch a movie with a girl than a boy.
Me too.
How is it for you to play a character, a female character written by men?
Again, because of the way that Sean and Nick like approached the performance and like allowed me to approach the performance, it kind of in the end felt like it was written by me as well. I felt like they just kind of gave me an outline for where things needed to go. But if there were words phrases or things that I did that felt unnatural or felt like something I wouldn't do, I would just tell them.
We needed to have a real person like her to help us with that character. It was always a unfinished kind of character in the script. I mean, he wrote it pretty well, actually.
He did.
Nick is very like tuned into youth His culture
feminine
and stuff.
Side. No, but there definitely are certain things that Nick just wouldn't understand, or like a decision-making process about certain things, even like the Troy thing that you just like wouldn't know without being a teenage girl.
That she's just driven by this, you know, the boy in the beginning of the film has actually been on her mind the entire journey, you know, and I just didn't realize that character would carry so much importance to a girl, but because he's such a dodo.
Yeah.
But girls like shitty guys, you know?
Yeah, and unfortunately.
I see that every day now. It's true.
No, that's not the takeaway. It's that not only that she's like, that he, I do think that the Troy character does drive a big part of the story, but it's her like disappointment in herself for like allowing herself to like let someone like that take up so much of the space in her world and her, like, I think when she realizes, like, wow, like, this is ruining my life, she's like, okay, like, that, like, there needs to be a change. But also, in the back of her head, as she's going through the journey, being like, oh, I can't wait. I like I was saying about like the part where Jacob's character Ian comes in, like she's there's a scene that was cut out, but she has like a confrontation with Troy at the end, and she's like, "You have no idea where I've been, what I've done, who I've been with," and I can just think like the entire time she was filming the movie and with Ian, she was like, "Fuck you, Troy, look where I am." That's a big part of it.
That's the empowerment you were talking about.
Being disappointed in yourself, though, is something that's definitely relatable for anybody.
Yeah.
Okay. Being driven by that.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks.
The Sweet East is out now and ready for you to experience here at Lab 111. Showtimes and tickets can be found on lab111.nl. Can't get enough of our interviews? Don't forget to listen to Elliot's recent review with filmmaker Baloji on his film Augur, and Hugo's interview with filmmaker Bertrand Bonello on his film The Beast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on whichever platform you're listening on and share so more people can find us. Make sure to subscribe and stay up to date with all new releases. If you want to join the conversation, feel free to send any questions at celebratingcinema@lab111.nl and follow us on @lab111 on Instagram. As always, we provide show notes, including all films mentioned, at celebratingcinema.com. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmerzau and artwork by Studio FFF.